Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining our seminar on open science. So as students in global studies, you're aware that most of the challenges that we are facing today transcend borders, cultures, and disciplines, okay? Issues like climate change, public health, economic inequality require not only local action, but also global understanding and collaboration, okay? So this is where open science becomes crucial in this field. By breaking down traditional barriers to information, open science advocates for a more accessible, transparent, and collaborative research. So we are pleased to have with us today Dr. Marcel Swart. Marcel Swart obtained his PhD degree in Groningen under the guidance of Prof. Berensen, Centers, and Snyders. After postdoctoral stays in Amsterdam, he was appointed an ICREA junior researcher in 2006, and in 2009, ICREA professor of theoretical chemistry at the IQCC Institute and Department of Chemistry of the University of Girona. He was chair of the Young Academy of Europe between 2017 and 18, main organizer of the Girona seminars between 2016-18, and from 2015 until 2023, he was a director of the IQCC Institute of the University of Girona. Currently, he is editor of Inorganica Chimica Acta, member of the SAPEA working group related to the work package on early and mine career researchers, member of the editorial college of CPOS Chemistry, community gateway advisor in organic chemistry, and collection advisor computational chemistry for Open Research Europe. So he has been funded by research projects of the Spanish Ministry of Science, GenCat, European Union, and participated in international projects. So over 8,000 times he has been cited. So he has delivered over 75 invited talks at international conference and research institutions. So he was elected Fellow of the Young Academy of Europe in 2014, Fellow of the Royal Society of Chemistry in 2015, and Member of the Academia Europea in 2019. So wow, many, many things. So we are so glad to have Marcel Swart today here with us. So please join me in welcoming Marcel Swart to the seminar, please. Many thanks.
So, thank you, Marta, for the kind introduction. I'm giving a course on open science for the grad school of University of Girona. And so this is this week, and today was also a good day to actually combine it to give a one-hour course on open science for you. Open science is all about sharing. Sharing is caring, which I would put there. Basically, it's sharing documents, results, but it's also sharing experiences, so collaborating with other people. And overall, there's five different aspects of open science where what actually affects us in our daily lives, but also in our scientific lives. So basically, this is related to research. So you have data, the analysis of the data, which lead to publications. These publications then can be published in different ways, and I will be explaining the different ways that we can actually publish these results. Like I already said, collaboration is a big part of it. You can also use it for education. Of course, we also have the tools to be able to do the work, both the collaboration, but also the writing and the evaluation, the analysis of the results. And one final part is the evaluation. This also, for your future, this is something which will be important. And basically, there are 11 components of open science, and shown here are the ones which I will be actually be going through in more detail today. So that will be open access, focusing on publications, open data, open source for software, reproducible research, because that is one other thing which open science actually facilitates, and evaluation and metrics. But the most important thing is sharing. And whenever you share something, you always have to be very careful for how you share this. So there's different licenses which you can use when sharing data, sharing papers, But also if you put figures online, if you have your own website, if you have your own blog, or if you share some things on social media, you do so with different licenses. You can put it all in the public domain. This is the CC0. You can also do it by, which is the most common one, the CC BY. So the Creative Commons for BY, which means that credit must be given to the creator. So anyone can reuse, adapt the content which you have put online. But if they want to use it or refer to it, they must give you credit for that it is you who created it. Then you can make them more restrictive, these licenses. You can make sure that they're not commercial. Or you can also restrict it that you don't want to have any adaptations, so non-derivatives. And you can make a combination of these things. Also notice that once you have chosen a license for sharing something, afterwards you cannot change it. So be very careful before you share anything online. In principle, you cannot change the license with which you have shared it. So open science in Europe was actually started with this guy in the middle, Carlos Moedas. Many of the things which, why I'm here today, why I'm actually teaching you about open science, is because around 2015 from the European Commission there was a big push for making open science reality. Before there were already initiatives, but not really with the big push which came around 2015. And Carlos Moedas, the Commissioner for Research at that time, he was one of the main drivers for that push. One of the things which also happened around the same time, that if you have a project which was funded by the EU, from 2017 onwards, your papers must be available in open access. Before that, there was not such a requirement. And I will be coming back to the open science. 2018, the European Commission and other funders came up with Plan S. I will be coming back to that as well. That is also one of the big things in Europe. So this was in 2015 that the European Commission started this. Plan S was 2018 and actually started in 2021. It was not until last year, so May 2023, that the Spanish government actually had their own strategy for open science. And this also is just a limited version of the open science. Here you see that the six parts which the Spanish government actually focuses on, open access, open data, open reviews, open source, citizen science, and open education, and evaluation. So the most important things are there, but there's other parts which are left out in this strategy. Also in the US, same year they also started with the open science. So they had the Biden and Harris administration announced last year that they were really pushing forward to open science. And also the NSF and the NIH really pushed forward to making 2023 the year of open science in the US. With the developments of this week, with the new president to be, science in US will not be the same, probably for the next 4 years. So it is questionable if the open science will still be such a big, strong part in the US in the coming 4 years. But at least it started. One of the things which we know most about science is about publications. We always have research and then we publish them. We can do this in different ways. We can do this in scientific papers or in books. That this depends on the discipline. Up until, let's say, early 2000s, the standard way, the traditional way of publishing, for instance, scientific papers, was basically the library had a subscription to journals, a selection of journals, depending on the interest of the people working in the university. And if you had some papers which were not included were included in journals which were not present at your own library, There was a service which we now have renewed at the university here, the Prestig Consortiat, where you could actually ask at other universities which do have that specific journal or that specific book what you're interested in to get a copy. Sometimes, in my case, for instance, it also meant that you had to physically go to a different city, to actually visit the library of different university to actually make a copy of some papers. And the selection of the journals was actually based on the journal impact factor. This was a service to librarians to make sure that they got the most bang for the buck. So they only wanted to pay for journals which they knew that were of interest to the researchers in the university. That was the only reason why we had this journal impact factor. And I will be coming back to that later. Then in the early 2000s, 2002, 2003, there were a number of conferences where they were actually discussing this, because basically the research what we're doing in the university is paid for by public money. So why would we have on top of that have to pay to be actually be able to read that? That's silly. It should be open. Anyone should be able to read what you have been producing, what kind of results we have obtained. So these were these three declarations. The most important one is the last one, the Berlin Declaration, which was also the biggest one, which was supported by many different organizations and foundations. Still, in the beginning, there were a limited number of open access journals, which were mainly organized by non-profit organizations, scientific organizations, etc. So there were not that many possibilities to actually publish in open access, until the traditional publishers caught on and saw that it was actually beneficial to many to actually be able to publish in open access. And then they opened up the hybrid route, which actually allowed anyone to publish in open access by paying a fee. You could publish in a classical journal by paying a fee, then your paper would be open access. Later on, this would be called the APC, article processing charges. Then there's different ways in which you can publish open access. The most well-known and most disputed one is the gold route. Gold means different things to different people. I've always understood it as you have to pay to get your paper in open access immediately. For other people, it means just immediate open access. So if you want to discuss this route, it's better to call it the immediate open access and not the gold route, because gold means different things to different people. This APC, which you have to pay, this depends on the journal. Many journals do not ask for an APC, but there are who actually pay, who have to pay for. And depending on the journal, it can be from, let's say, $100 to close to 10,000 euros if you want to publish in Nature. So if your funder obliges you to have immediate open access, and you happen to be so unlucky in this way, to have a paper accepted in Nature, you have to pay 10,000 euros. That's a lot. Then you have the green route. You can actually deposit a copy of your own version on a repository, which can be an institutional one, which we have in University of Girona, DubiDoc, or you can have a community-based repository. Or, depending on the journal, you can just put it on your own website. This depends very much on the journal, if they allow this or not. Some journals actually are really happy to do so, others are really restrictive and do not allow this. Or allow this only after an embargo. Could be up to 2 years. Then there are the diamond journals. Basically, these are free to read for the public and also free to publish for the authors. So basically, the ideal situation. But of course, the journals do have costs, and I'm also involved in one of these, SciPost. Basically, what they do is every year they make a list of all the authors and the institutions that have published in these papers, in these journals, and then they basically ask the institutions where these authors are working for a contribution towards the cost of this publishing. There's also another one, the Diamond Plus. It exists, but I do not know too many that actually are existing, where not only do the reader not pay, the author does not pay, the author gets paid. paid to publish them. But that's a really rare situation. Like I already said, the hybrid routes, this is the most controversial one because it's basically, in many cases, double dipping. Because you already pay for a subscription, and on top of that, you have to pay to get your paper published in open access in it. So that is really a controversial issue. And in the Netherlands, and starting in 2017, there was a transformative deal where all libraries, universities, institutions came together and put all their money together in one lump sum, and then paid with the different publishers, paid them a fixed amount. Whenever the sending offer of a paper was coming from the Netherlands, automatically this paper would be in open access. Later on, also in Germany, they had a similar deal, but that only for the publishers in Germany. And in 2021, I think it was that we had in Spain, we have also such a transformative agreement. It is limited in the sense compared to the ones in Germany and Netherlands, but at least there are some publishers, when you send something there, there is a number of papers which will be able to publish in open access every year. And this percentage of papers in open access with these publishers increases every year. So for instance, Elsevier, 56% in 2021, goes up to 75% in 2024. Then you also have the closed plus. Basically, you have really popular journals that have made an online open access version of it. Completely different editorial team, different scope, but with the same prestige, at least that is the idea. For instance, there's Jax Gold or Fisref X are two examples. And these are then completely open access journals. So they're completely accepted by the funders. Also, there's this list, the directory of open access journals, around 21,000 journals right now are listed in it. Almost 14,000 of those do not charge for APCs. However, not all of them are included in the GCR, the Journal Citation Reports, which lists the most important journals for different disciplines. Now we'll be coming back to that later. A different way of doing things in open access is using preprint service. And that is a new way in the sense for many disciplines. It was very common in mathematics and in some parts of physics, where they just basically, you send your publication to the preprint server over here, and once it is accepted and published over there, afterwards you send it to the journal. You go to the standard routes, so you have your peer review, you have other people going through it, you adapt your manuscript to the comments from the reviewers, and then at a certain moment you have your accepted version. And the important thing of this is something which came out of the discussion on Plan S in around 2018. Up until this point, it was really depending on the journal at which point your copyright would be going towards the journal or not. With the discussion on Plan S, and I will be discussing that later, it was really clear that up until this point, until the author accepts the manuscript, this is the copyright of the authors. Afterwards, you give the copyright to the journal to make it nice, to get it everything in the way that they want to, do the typesetting, sometimes do also the language cleaning, et cetera, et cetera. And then they finally have the version of record. This is the finally published version. That is clearly with the copyright of the publisher. But up until the author accepts the manuscript, this is copyright of the author. And this you can share freely in principle with Green Open Access if the journal allows it. Like I already said, the Plan S came in 2018. This was a really big, bold move from the European Commission and the European funders. It is supported by a number of national funders together with the European Commission. And surprisingly, the ERC is one of the big European funders on research. It withdrew in July 2020. They didn't agree anymore on the terms of Plan S. Basically, what the main idea of Plan S is that whenever you have research coming out of a project which is funded by any one of these funders, the publications must be available in open access immediately upon acceptance. And then there was some other terms. The most important additional term in this list is the one highlighted here in bold, that the hybrid model is not acceptable for Plan S. That was a big problem, and this also led to lots of shock. So this is a book from Robert Jan Smits from 2022, where he actually described the whole process of Plan S. And also, I'm also listed in it, basically because I actually did a study on Plan S and how it would affect the researchers in Europe. For instance, I took in 2018, I looked at 10 different disciplines and looked at the DOAJ, so the Directory of Open Access Journals, and I looked at the journal citation reports. This is a list of the most important journals per discipline. So I looked at this list of most important journals for per discipline, and I looked at how many of these are actually open access. And there were actually quite few. For instance, in chemistry, I'm a chemist, only 4% of the most important journals were open access. If you restrict us chemists to actually publish only in open access, it means that we are not allowed to publish in the 96% most important journals. This is a big problem. Also, when I showed it to Robert Jan Smits and others, he was also like shocked because he couldn't believe it, that it was so bad. And 2 years later, I repeated it, not just for those 10, but all of the 229 categories within the JCR. The main conclusions are, out of the almost 13,000 journals within the JCR, only 13% are open access. Half of them have less than 10% of open access journals, and 17 of these categories have zero open access journals. So if you're working in one of these disciplines, there is no journal for you to publish in, if you're funded by Plan S. And this is just an overview of these numbers. There's more in the blog. Because of all these things, and also the funders had to implement the rules, they actually made an exception, so they allowed to publish in hybrid journals, but they would not pay for the APCs. If you wanted to pay the fee for that from other money, that would be fine. So that is one way that you could actually do that, as long as the manuscript is immediately open access available. You can also use the green open access or the pre-printing route. That was also something, basically the compromise between Plan S and the researchers, that we could also use that. And there was also an exceptional situation for certain journals which were actually closed access but was moving over towards going open access in a transformative agreement. For a number of years, these would also be accepted by the funders. Earlier this year, the Gates Foundation really made a big move. Up until now, they were just paying any APCs for any open access journals, but they started to be paying a lot of money, much more than they anticipated in the beginning. So now they have made a big move. Starting next year, all the authors which are funded by Gates Foundation must be using preprinting service, because that's for free. And that's open access. Because they basically, what the Gates Foundation says, we don't want to use our money to pay publishers. We want our money to be funding research. So that's one thing which is a new development of this year, and probably there will be more funders which will be following this route. In my view, the ideal open access is the one based on the Dutch or the German model, where actually you have a read and publish agreement. You pay a fixed amount of money to the publishers each year, and that is that. Also, ideally, if you send this manuscript to a journal, ideally, automatically, the journal would send it to a preprint server. And it actually is happening already. A few weeks ago, I sent it to one journal, and the journal automatically sent it to the preprint. But that's really a nice service by the journals, Wiley Journal with it. Of course, the important thing is, are APCs worthwhile? So is it really worthwhile to publish in open access? And here the evidence is mixed. This is from Frontiers, a study from, I think, 2020-2021, which compared a number of different top journals in open access, top journals in traditional publishers, and then looked at the citations on average for the papers in those journals. You can see that 3.1 on average for the traditional journals and 3.8 for the open access journals. So there is really a benefit for publishing in open access. And that in some way makes also sense, because anyone can actually see it. You're not limited, you're not restricting access to your results. So it's logical that it would be like that. However, there's also other studies. This is from 22, which looked at specific cohort, so 40 people from Israel, 20 STEM, 20 social sciences and humanities. And basically the main conclusion was there is not really a difference between open access and closed access. It might be because it is just a small cohort, it's only 40 people, and I think they only looked at a few hundred papers, or 600 papers. Funnily enough, there was one journal which was open access. They actually had really problems surviving. They didn't get enough contributions, and so they were spending much time just trying to get people to contribute and keeping the level up of the quality. At a certain moment, they were just tired of it. We could just go back to the traditional way, and suddenly the paper started coming in again. So after they went from open to closed, the impact of the journal actually increased. It probably is an exception, but it is funny. I've talked most about papers. Papers are really the ones which are actually experiencing this Plan S and the open access. Other disciplines mainly are about books, where you actually publish your research in books. This is really different, because the cost of publishing a book is mostly borne by the author, not by the journal or the publisher. So this is really different. And there's also legal issues involved, so Plan S and other funders were actually not touching the books. There is not yet a requirement for publishing books in open access. There's only encouragement. If you publish books, then they encourage people to actually publish them in open access. And then there is the different incentives to actually guide, and also the guidelines to actually for the publishing in open books. Initially with Fringe Plan S, it was mentioned that in 2025, books would be involved as well, that you have to publish the books in open access. This had now been delayed further, so now they're talking about during the next framework program in Europe, so that's between 2027 and 2034. At a certain moment, books will be have to be published in open access. So how does it work here in Spain? In Spain, this is from 2019, but it is still the same situation today. Open access is needed for papers, but there is an embargo allowed, so you have until 6 and 12 months after the paper has been published, and then it must be available in open access. One of the new things, this is from 2019, is open data. Open data is not yet a requirement at the European level, but at the Spanish level in 2019, they already introduced that if you have a research project funded by the ministry, 2 years after the end of the project, all of the data coming from that project must be available in open. And I will be coming back to the open data in a minute. So that's something else. This is the first time in Europe that a funder actually is obliging people to actually be publishing the data in open. Like I already said, we have the open access. Now we go to the open data. And what is actually the open data? Which data should you publish? So if you do research, it's not only the research. You're not creating data alone. You can also look at results from others and use that in your own research to compare, and et cetera. The data from other people is not the things which you then do share, because it's the data from other people. It seems obvious, but it's also important to make that distinction. Basically, the data which you have to put in open data are the ones which you have generated within your research. So just an example, I had one of the, in the last courses, last couple of years, there was one student who she was working on maps of Europe during the medieval period from, I think, 600 to 1500. Those maps are not open data, which she would have to put in the open. Her interpretation of these maps, how these change, that is the thing which they have to do. The same with poets. If you have a poet which has written text, the original text is not the data which you put. For instance, if you have a poet in the Italian which has been translated 100 times, and you compare the different translations and make a new one, that is the data which you then put out in the open. In chemistry, it's more easy because we synthesize molecules, we do NMR, we do characterize the molecules, and these are the data which we put in the open. But there's also another thing which is important to realize, and I think the Spanish government is already doing that in a good way. It's not only the data which you're using for a paper which you have to put out there. Also, the negative results are really important that you put the data out there. If you're trying something, and for instance in chemistry, we try to make a new molecule, and actually it doesn't work. It's important that you actually put that information out there, because there will be 10 other groups who are trying to do the same. If they would have known already in the beginning that it doesn't work, it is important information. There was also from May this year, there was a big news item in Nature on that. So negative results are really important. And I already mentioned the ERC, so the European Research Council. They are handing out lots of projects every year, between 500 and 1,000 projects of 1.5 million to 3 million to researchers. And these are really, really competitive projects. And they are really focused from the beginning on open data. They had a pilot project on open data. What are the important things? How do you actually treat the open data? What do you need for open data? Because we know how it works with papers. We know how papers work. We know how to publish them. They were already open, available. With the data, it was not so clear. And they were really important for defining the things which we need for the open data. Also notice, this was also around the same period, so 2015, 2016, when there was a big push for open science. There was also the FAIR guiding principles for scientific data management. And the FAIR basically means the data must be findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. Findable means that in chemistry, for instance, we always use the data that were published together with the paper in the supporting information. But unless you know that, for instance, my colleague Mikael Kostas is working on iron for oxo complexes, you cannot search for it. There was no way that you could actually search for, I want to study some molecules with iron for oxo, blah, blah, blah. There's no way that you can do that. So there must be a way that you can actually search for data in a convenient and useful way. Accessible means that there should be available. Anyone should be able to access and read and view the data. Interoperable means that it shouldn't be restricted to only those who have a Windows 7.0 machine. It should be available to anyone at any time in any format. And reusable, so it's really important, the licensing, I already mentioned that in the beginning, the license to actually be able to reuse the data. This is an important aspect. So these were the guidelines which were defined in 2016. And the EOC was really instrumental in defining how you actually do that. And that is called the data management plan. So whenever you have a project, you need to define how you're going to handle the data in your data management plan. And this is just simple things, a description of what the data, the formats, the licensing, etc. And I will be going that through this now. There are some tools online which can actually make your own DMP. This is one from the initial ones from the UK. But since a few years in Catalonia, we have here the AENA DMP, and it's really useful. Basically, if you want to make a DMP, you need to define if these results are coming from a project. You have to just give the information of the project. What is the title? What is the reference of the project? When does it start? When does it end? Who funded it, etc.? Then about the data. What is the purpose of the data? Which kind of data do you generate? Do you generate them or do you reuse them? Where are they coming from? Do you do this or do someone else did that? What is the size of the data, expected size? Is it just 1 megabyte or is it 1 terabyte? All these kinds of things need to be done. And data utility means who else could be interested in this data? Fair. How are you going to make it fair? How are you going to make it findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable? Resources. Who is going to pay for it? Does it cost anything to actually store or generate them? And typically, if you have a project, the project will pay for it. But if you don't have a project, how are you going to pay for that? Who's responsible for it as well? So in the end, someone has to be responsible for the data management, and that should also be included in the data management plan. And also, how are you going to preserve it? How are you going to make sure that, for instance, if you have a PhD student doing the research, how are you going to make sure that after the PhD student leaves, the data will still be available? That is all in the data management plan as well. Security is also a thing. How are you going to store it? How are you going to handle sensitive data? And this depends again on the discipline. Chemistry, we don't have too much of that. But in other disciplines, it is a really a big problem. You need ethical committee to go through this. And then there's other things, like really ethics, legal issues. There could be local issues. All of these things must be included in the data management plan. So basically, it's the description of not of the data, of which kind of data and how you're going to handle that, how you're going to make sure that the data will be available. The next thing is repositories, because you have to store them somewhere. You can use, like for instance, we have here in Catalonia nowadays, the Quora. You can store them there. But it's also a bit of, it's good that it's there, don't get me wrong, but it's also a bit of a waste, because similar to open access, just publishing a paper in open access doesn't make it accessible in the normal sense to my colleagues. If I publish a paper in chemistry in an open access journal of archaeology, my colleagues will not read it because they don't read the archaeology journal. Even though it's open access, no one will read it. So it's really important that you publish it somewhere where you actually, your colleagues are actually reading it. The same is true of the repositories. Unless you'd actually tell people that you have the data, if your colleagues do not know that the data exists, they will not use it. Therefore, it's always best to actually use a community-based repository, if available. And for those which do not have a repository, then you can go to the Quora to actually make sure that it is there. But then you also need to add metadata, because you need to explain. If you just have 3 numbers, it doesn't mean anything. You have to explain what these numbers mean. So that's an important thing. You also have to look at, make sure that the repository is stable and existing and in 10 years' time. And again, the ERC is really a pioneer, and it's also included in the definition of the data management plan. They also have, for each of the disciplines, they have listed the most important repositories in the discipline. And also NIH, NSF. One of the things which often is overlooked by funders, but also policymakers, is data, how to assess them. I was in 2015, I was in Brussels for a meeting with the European Commission, talking about open data, open science in 2030. And their idea of 2030 would be, the moment that you generate data, it should be open, somewhere, in the cloud. And this is a bit silly, because data on its own is useless, unless you specify exactly what is this that you put there. So there's the community part. Also, it really depends on the internet. So I had a European project at the time, and I actually asked several colleagues of mine to actually do this test to check the internet speed from different countries. And basically, the results were like this. On average, we had less than 10 megabytes per second download speed and around 4 megabytes per second upload speed. However, there were also some which actually had 1.6 megabits, so that's 0.2 megabytes per second download, and well, the upload was really bad. So if you would be needing to upload 1 gigabyte of data using this connection, it would take you 3 days. And this is just 1 gigabyte. I have a colleague, she generates 1 terabyte of data for every project, and she has at least, I would say, 8 students. Each one has its own project. That is lots of data. If you would have to store that, apart from storing it somewhere, you generate such an amount of data. Just uploading 1 terabyte of data would take you 20 days. During those 20 days, that connection has to be active all the time. If there is a electricity fallout after 19 days, boop, you're back to zero. Again, 20 days. So that's something which especially policymakers often forget, that there is a, oh, and this was in Barcelona, one of the university. There is really something involved. One of the things which I really like, and this is interactive data, normally you have a figure in 2 dimensions. A few years back already in chemistry, they started to make interactive open data. I tried it yesterday, and yesterday it didn't work, so I will not try it today to show that it actually is working. But basically, you can actually just take the figure, and if you want to interest it in the density in a different way, you can actually visualize it in a different way. You can rotate it, visualize it in 3D in a different way. And that's, I think, in some ways, could be the data for the future. An important thing which is also related to why we need open data is reproducible research. Because there's also many people that actually are cheating. And also, sometimes not cheating, but just making errors. I have a colleague in Groningen who actually, whenever he has a new student, they have to repeat an experiment on one thing, but he knows the answer. And he knows how long it takes. So it's typically between 2 and 5 days. The better student do it in 2 days, the weaker students do it in 5 days. And he had a new student, and on the first afternoon, the first day, she was just sitting in the afternoon at the office, like bored, and he was like, come on, I told you what to do. And she said, well, I've already done it. Nah, it cannot be, you need at least 2 days, and well, no, it's a, there are the results and whatever. So he looked at the results and like, a yield of 20%. No, you're cheating. The maximum yield which you can get is 16%. I've done this with so many students, I've done it myself, maximum yield is 16%. And she was like, no, these are the results, 20%. And he didn't believe her, also because it was so fast. So he made it redo it again, and indeed it was really fast, and 20%. So it's really important to be able to reproduce research. This is a pub peer, this is anonymous. You can actually, if you find a paper, and you think like, I'm not sure if this is actually correct. And this is especially in biomedicine, where you have these kinds of pictures. And for instance, in this case, I think it is this part which is actually copied over there. Here it is MCM7, there it is lamin B. So clearly the authors have actually just copy-pasted. This is not the original data. And this is also from a few weeks ago. There was a PI who started a new lab, and she had a postdoc. She had wonderful results. It was published, and then because of those results, she could do additional research. So she got funding for the additional research, got a new PhD student, and before they could actually move on to the next steps, the student had to get used to the experiments, so they had to reproduce the results of the postdoc. Couldn't get it. Was really trying hard, like months and months and months. Couldn't get it. And she was so stressed. And then another student came in because there was another project which was funded, having the same. No problem. No way that you could actually reproduce. Those two students, after a few months, they just left because of the stress and the pressure. Later on, they found out that it's not correct. The original data from the postdoc were wrong, were fraud. And that's something which is really important. And if you have the open data, you can actually check that immediately. And this was actually stuck. But it's not just starting PIs who have this. So this is Frances Arnold, Nobel Prize winner of 2018 in chemistry. Her first tweet in 2020 was, "I'm sorry, but I have to retract the paper. We just cannot reproduce the data." So it's not just starting PIs, it can happen to anyone, because you're also working with a team and doesn't necessarily have to be malicious. Open source is another part. This is one of the tools which we use to actually be able to do open science. You have, for instance, OpenOffice, where different people are working together to make software which we can use. You also have more specific scientific discipline dependent software, which you can then use, share, for instance, for GitHub. Then you have different languages, Fortran, C++, C, Python. Others put it, the complete software, on their website, like Markus Reyer in Zurich did. I typically put the executables and the scripts on my website. But one of the big examples of how it actually works is, a few weeks ago, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry went to these guys, but especially these two on the right-hand side. They were given the Nobel Prize for protein folding. Protein folding was an important problem in chemistry, which we didn't get right. Started already in 1969. Many different people had tried with different tools, different ways, and up until, let's say, 2006, the best which you could get compared to experimental structures, where we know exactly what it looks like, was like the order of 35%. And that stayed until 2016, until these two guys, who are now working at Google, started what is called AlphaFold using machine learning. So the first version was okay-ish, but not yet good. But AlphaFold 2 in 2020 already gave you close to 90% accuracy, which means that basically when you have just the primary sequence, you can determine the three-dimensional structure of proteins. Up until that time, we only had around 300,000 experimental structures in the protein database. Now, with this tool, we have 100 million of protein structures which are just available. And you can actually look at that, and you can actually use that. And this is why they also got the Nobel Prize for it. The final part I want to focus on, evaluation, which was basically for your future. Because at a certain moment, you may be applying for the fellowship. You may be applying for a position at the faculty, a staff position. You may be applying for a project. All of the applications need to be evaluated. There are some people that are just looking at numbers, like how many Nature papers does this guy have, how many science papers, etc. That's not useful. There has been a tendency in the last 20 years to actually use the journal impact factor as a way of actually evaluating the research, which is silly, because the journal impact factor is on the journal, not of a specific paper within it. And also, it's really field dependent. And it depends on the size of the community. In order to show that, actually, Stu Cantrell, the editor of Nature Chemistry, who actually wrote, well, if you want to know how good a paper is, read it. Don't look at the journal paper. Read it and see if you actually like it or not. But he also said, wouldn't it be nice if you just have one paper, publish it in 10 different journals, and see what's the impact that? Of course, you cannot do that, because that is plagiarism. You cannot just publish one paper more than once. But there was one example which you looked at. This was a clinical trial protocol, which was published at the same time and at different places. And these are the 8 journals which he looked at. And then he looked, this was published in 2007. Then he looked at the end of 2011 at the number of citations that the same paper had obtained in these different journals. Basically, it means that, what he showed was that the one with the larger impact, the journal impact factor, had the largest number of citations. Basically, it means that the community, the number of people that actually read New England Journal of Medicine, is much larger than the Lancet, and much larger than the Croatian Medical Journal. Because if you cite the paper, you cite it in the journal in which you have read it. So basically what you see here is actually the proof that the journal impact factor is actually just the size of the community reading that journal. There's nothing with the quality involved. You also have the H index and the M index, the modified here H index. H index basically means how many papers of a certain researcher have been cited how many times. If you have mean H index 2, it means that you have 2 publications which have been published 2 times. Of course, it's not really valid because then you cannot compare early stage researchers with senior researchers. So this is why they divide it by M, the number of years since the first publication, that more or less get a more equitable number, but it's still not useful. And it also sometimes is used as an analysis of how good a researcher is. But again, this goes back to the same issue. This depends on the field. This depends on the community that actually you're working in. So you cannot compare 2 different people from 2 different communities just because they are different in community size. And this led to the San Francisco DORA assessment declaration. Basically, it mentions that you cannot use things like the journal impact factor or the H index for evaluating people. So if you cannot use the H index, what are the other things? And this is something which the European Commission has been working on, and for instance, you can use, because you want to focus on open science, what is the percentage of papers that are actually available in open access? And there's these tools available, like Dissemin. You can actually check, this is from a few years from my part. So you can actually check, so there's 186 papers found. So many were in open access by the journal, so many by the author themselves, so many could have been open access, but are not, etc. So that's one metrics. Then there is this the Stanford ranking. This is started a few years ago. It's a standardized way of measuring impact. It's based on the Scopus database, but basically they do it in a different way. And this right now it's more than 200,000 scientists all over the world, and they measure the impact and then they make a ranking. This is from data from 2019. 17 researchers from the UDG are listed in it, 24 in the ranking for each of the years. So the 17 for the career, among which one over here. But basically, it's a way of standardizing ranking citations. It's still rankings, and it's not sure if it'd actually be good. So then the Netherlands in 2019, they actually started doing things in a different way. Room for everyone's talent. Because it's not just research which is important. Teaching is also really important. You want to have good teachers. You want to have good professors that can actually teach you on different topics. And if you don't include that in your evaluation, this is something which you really missing out. And also part of it is that you don't have these metrics, you don't have the H index, you don't have the journal impact factor, etc. These are not allowed. Instead, you have a written, a narrative CV. So it's, yeah, you can actually point out strong points of your career. And I'm sure that within a few years, this will also move over to Europe and then also move over to Spain. So within 10 years, probably we'll have such a system here in Spain as well. In 22, the European Commission took this up and took it in a more general way. There was this, all kinds of workshops and discussions on that. And basically, including a new evaluation system, including teaching, administration, policy work, representative works, etc. Also impact of research, but just this one of the things. These are important things. And they started, based on the recommendations from those workshops, they started with the COARA, Coalition for Advancing Research Assessment. And this is one way that we can actually move over. And well, this is just the recommendations for in general of COARA. Basically, it means that you have to implement these within 5 years after signing the agreement that you sign up to the COARA. You have to go over to a fair evaluation system. And there's really just everything is described in this COARA agreement, how you should do that. And it's important for you as well is that University of Girona was one of the first to sign up in Spain. So UDG will be fair assessing in the within a few years. Finally, I want to have just a few words on communication. Use your social media wisely. Before I always said Twitter, but I'm completely with the Musk problems, moved over to Blue Sky and LinkedIn. It's really important for you to be visible. If you want to have a career in science, it's really important that you are visible. And this can be in different ways. It can also be really useful for connecting with editors. So, still on Twitter, at a certain moment, I had a discussion with some Stu Cantrell. In the beginning, I was like, who are you? Because I was always, in 2016, Ben Feringa won the Nobel Prize, and I was always vouching for Ben Feringa to win the Nobel Prize. And he was asking, but why Ben Feringa? Why not Stu Stoddard? And I was like, who are you to ask me about that? Then I realized, oh, it's actually the editor of Nature Chemistry. Oh, that's good. So then later on, I actually saw on Twitter that Nature Chemistry was actually promoting some conferences with poster prizes. I was organizing a conference in 2016, you know, in a seminar. So I asked this to, I know that you do poster prizes. Would you sponsor us? And he said, yeah, sure. So in 2016, the poster prizes of the Journal and Seminar were sponsored by Nature Chemistry. Just because I knew him from Twitter. That is the way that you can actually make connections. So you have to be visible, if possible, through a website, and also on LinkedIn. And don't be afraid to ask professors to connect on LinkedIn. It's really useful for your career. Also, if there are some visiting professors, meet them for scientific discussions, because it will be useful for your in future. They may be in your evaluation panel in 10 years' time. And also have an elevator pitch. So if you meet this famous professor and you go with him in the elevator, make sure that you have 15 seconds that you can actually explain who you are, what you're doing, and why you know him or her, and what you work. If you are going to present presentations with PowerPoint, maximum 20 words per slide. This slide is wrong. Many more words. Keep it simple. Keep it short. Also, if you're going to present your work conclusions, don't write the whole sentence that you're going to say. Just do the most important words in the conclusions. Less is more. And the floor is yours is a good way of actually learning how to do that. Also add slide numbers, like here, 91. The audience can actually go back to that. On slide 87, you said, you can actually go really fast to slide 87. I will show you. You just put the number and enter. That's a really fast way. You don't have to slide with all the going back. Just if you know the number of the slide, this is also why it's useful to put the slide number up, because if someone from the audience asks you, on slide 44, you don't have to scroll like crazy. Like, I'm now at 91. If I have to scroll all the way back to 44, it will take 5 minutes. This is a fast way. And also remember slide numbers. If you have a question from the audience, when you were talking about open science and open data, blah, 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 and you remember that, I don't remember it now, but suppose it was at around 60, and you do the same trick. 60, go to that page. Even if you're not exactly at the same page, but you're close to it, it makes it easy. If you have it correct, exactly correct, you have the audience. He knows his presentation. That's an important way. And well, this is something, it's a pity that you don't know Dutch, but there was a Belgian which were actually making a joke of, if Martin Luther King would be alive now, instead of having his famous speech, he would be using PowerPoint. And this is a really funny way of showing that, how you can actually do things wrong with PowerPoint. Also a different way, this is something which, if you really want to have the attention of the audience, you don't want to have them look at the screen. It's easy. The B, black. W, white. It's really easy to actually focus your attention to you, because you don't want them to have a focus on the screen. You don't want them to read what is on the screen if you have something really important to tell them. And last thing, never, ever, ever, ever use the Comic Sans font, because you want to be taken seriously. You want to be professional. So never ever use Comic Sans unless you're a physicist. If you're a physicist, you should use Comic Sans. So with that, I've come to the end. Thank you.